This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of November 23rd, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Krieg DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As we've discussed for several months now, the pandemic has been disastrous for some of the core industries on which Central Indiana's economy is built. We rely on high-profile sports events and conventions to bring millions of visitors to the city to spend the night and spend their money. It very likely will take years to get back up to speed. But we received monumental news last week of a development that could ease the pain and quicken the recovery. The NCAA, aka the governing body of collegiate sports, the City of Indianapolis, and State of Indiana announced that they were in preliminary talks to host the entire 2021 NCAA men's basketball tournament in the Indianapolis area. The whole thing, all of March Madness, all 68 teams, 67 games over three weekends. And typically, of course, this takes place at more than a dozen sites around the country. This would be all Indianapolis, or Central Indiana, all the time, hopefully to simplify the logistics and keep the teams as safe and isolated as possible. Now, this is not entirely a surprise in that the Final Four already was scheduled to take place in Indianapolis on April the 3rd and 5th. Also, the NCAA is based in Indianapolis and has long-standing relationships with all the major players. And we should say that certainly includes the Indiana Sports Corporation, which is in the middle of all this as the not-for-profit group that leads local efforts to bring major sports events to Indianapolis. Now, at the moment, they're all very tight-lipped about the negotiations and potential preparations. I think we're safe in saying that the players are much farther along in negotiations than they're admitting at the moment, but we'll get to that in a minute. It's hard to say exactly what this all would look like come March. For example, where the games would be played, where the players would stay, what level of precautions they'll need to create these virus-free bubbles. But we're going to take a stab at it today. For our guests on this week's podcast, we're joined by two prominent sports business consultants, as well as IBJ reporter Mickey Shuey, who covers the business of sports and hospitality. We want to get a sense of what's happening behind the scenes, the issues that organizers are trying to iron out, where the games could be played, and the potential risks and rewards for Indianapolis. Here's our conversation. I am pleased to welcome several great guests to the IBJ Podcast virtual studio this week. We have Mark Gannis, president and co-founder of Chicago-based Sports Corp. Limited, a sports business consultancy. Welcome, Mark. Thanks for taking time today.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by Larry DeGaris, a professor of marketing at the University of Indianapolis School of Business. He also works as a sports marketing and sponsorship consultant. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Mickey Shuey, who covers the business of sports, as well as the hospitality industry, which will be relevant for reasons that will become apparent pretty soon for the Indianapolis Business Journal. Mickey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Mark, I want to start with you, just to bring everybody up to date. The NCAA, City of Indianapolis, and State of Indiana have confirmed that they're in what they are calling preliminary talks to stage all of March Madness in the Indianapolis area. In reality, how far along do you think they are at this point toward reaching a final agreement?
If they are, to make an announcement of this kind, that indicates that they're actually much further along than just preliminary discussions. They would make an announcement like this for two primary reasons. One is because they may need to go through some public process to get approvals, financing, commitments, get the hotels on board, things like that. The second is to tell the member schools to prepare for it. So they would not be offering both a place and a set of conditions if they didn't feel that it was something that was viable, frankly, unless it was something that was likely. And so I think they're actually further along than just exploratory or preliminary stages.
Yeah, I mean, what are the chances that this could end up somewhere else at this point?
There's always a chance that that's the case until the final deal is done, until they get all the commitments in place from all the different parties, private as well as public sector parties that are necessary. But Indianapolis and Indiana, and they've all shown up before many times for these kinds of events. It's unlikely that they would they would punt, but it's possible. You know, we're in a strange year in 2020, and there are considerations and concerns that haven't been on the table before. So it's always possible. But again, I don't think they would have made the public announcement unless they felt that it was likely to happen and that this was their target.
So my big question as I consider this is, what is going on behind the scenes right now as these negotiations take place? Like, what elements of this undertaking are the NCAA, the city and the state, and I assume the Indiana Sports Corp too, what are they trying to nail down? And anybody's welcome to jump in here.
Yeah, so what I've been hearing from my sources is that really all those parties are getting into rooms, or I guess in this case into Zooms, and trying to hash out all the details, where things would be located, what testing protocols will look like, whether fans will be allowed, and I'm sure we'll get into that here in a little bit. But really, they're just trying to iron out each and every segment of this deal and how this tournament would look. I think we're still a few weeks away, but they are definitely in the process of shoring up all the small details of this deal.
My big question on this is whether or not the sponsors are going to show up. Hospitality has basically been canceled. And I'm wondering what the event would look like without corporate hospitality and kind of fans only. I will tell you that my students really picked up on this story. I try to get them to read the news all the time. They don't always, but this story they jumped on, and I'll tell you, there's certainly a buzz around college students. So while the corporate sponsors may not show up, the students definitely will if they're allowed.
That was one of the really interesting things when we hosted the Super Bowl that I really wasn't aware of, was how much of the activity around the event is all driven by sponsors. This could look at from on the ground as to be a very different kind of event.
Well, the impact there, we shouldn't make an assumption of any meaningful positive impact on the city of Indianapolis. The reason for that is because they're highly unlikely that we're going to have a lot of visitors coming in, and that's really where the impact takes place, the economic impact takes place, hotels, restaurants, taxi cabs, those kinds of things. And that's not that we shouldn't assume that we'll have any fans or certainly any large number of fans allowed to come into the area. But the point that you're making about the Super Bowl and all the events around it, that's if you actually attend. The percentage of people who actually attend a Super Bowl or Final Four or March Madness game, semifinals, compared to as a relation to the number of people who watch it on TV, get information through social media, bet on it online or in sports books, see highlights in social media feeds, it's infinitesimal compared to the people. So it's not that big of a deal to not have the people on site and the events on site. It's big to Indianapolis.
It's true that economic impact for these events is typically measured in heads and beds, so the number of visitors. I think that really sells short the economic opportunities presented by events like this, which a lot of them are in the B2B relationship, so a lot of them are into corporate hospitality. So, when you have local companies that can host and you have all the major corporate players coming into town, it's a huge opportunity for them to develop business relationships that potentially can far outweigh the consumer spending on bars and restaurants, hotels.
One of the things that occurred to me is that while we're not going to nearly have the kind of direct economic impact that we would see from, a regular event, the amount of earned media, the value of earned media of having every game broadcast from somewhere in the Indianapolis area sounds immense to me. I mean, is that really valuable?
This year, maybe a little less than most years, but what will show up is that Indianapolis was able to put everything together to host such a major event. And I wouldn't underplay how valuable that will be down the road as Indianapolis goes after other events. They can say in the COVID era, they put on the entire March Madness in one community. That's a pretty big deal. And that's a hell of an accomplishment.
And that's what I'm hearing on my end too, is a lot of the city leaders and city officials, especially in the tourism industry, are thinking that this could really be a big win for Indianapolis in terms of a long-term play to attract other events here, because other events are going to see Indianapolis was able to pull this off, as Mark alluded to. And if it goes off without a hitch, then that's going to be immensely valuable for Indianapolis's portfolio and stock, especially as it prepares to build another addition to the convention center.
I think it's also important for the people who live in Indianapolis. So, we've done research that shows a pretty strong relationship between community engagement and sports involvement. And overall, Indianapolis, the people who live here don't really have an unfavorable opinion of living in Indy overall. But that's not true for sports fans. And this is in every category. So there's differences by age and income, as you'd expect. The older and the more affluent you are, the more you like living in Indianapolis. But sports fans in every category have a stronger ties to the community. And I think the timing of it, so hopefully for this event, the timing will be as we're coming out. Right, that we'll start to see, that we'll see green shoots, and so it's a tremendous opportunity to bring the community together.
I just want to tag something on to what Larry was just saying about the relationship between the city and sports fans. That being that Indianapolis historically has done an incredible job of bringing out volunteers for its events that it hosts here. The Indiana Sports Corp is really one of the nation's leaders when it comes to drawing out volunteers. That relationship that's been built over the years is going to be incredibly valuable as they look for fans to volunteer to come out for this year's tournament if it's held here.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
Okay, we're back with the latest edition of the IBJ Podcast. This week, we're talking with sports consultants Mark Gannis and Larry DeGaris, along with IBJ reporter Mickey Shuey, about what it would mean for the Indianapolis area to host the entire NCAA men's basketball tournament this spring.
What are the risks for Indianapolis? I can think of one obvious one, but the rewards could be great. But isn't this taking a really big chance?
There's one obvious risk, other than the community spread of COVID, is that they spend a tremendous amount of time, a tremendous amount of effort, be completely ready to go, and there's another spike in COVID, and the politicians say you can't do it, or local, county, state, or the NCAA says we can't take this risk. So there's a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of effort. That will go into this, and there may be events completely outside of the NCAA or the local officials' control that dictate that the entire event may be scrapped.
Now, one of the questions I think people first have is, well, where are you going to hold all the games? I am now going to have a list of places where you can hold all the games. For folks who aren't from Indianapolis, here's what we're dealing with. In downtown Indianapolis, we have Bankers Life Fieldhouse, where the Indiana Pacers play. In addition to the main floor, there's also at least one practice court. There may be more now that they have that St. Vincent Center there. Lucas Oil Stadium, where they're going to stage the Final Four. I don't know if they would also want to open that up for other games. We also have the Indiana Convention Center, where the ballrooms can be configured to create several basketball courts. 5 miles north of downtown, we have Butler University and Hinkle Fieldhouse. Also about 5 miles north of downtown, the Indiana Farmers Coliseum. These both, I think, hold about 8,000-9,000 people. both places where, you know, they televise sports events. Also in Indianapolis, Marion University has a gym. University of Indianapolis has a gym. I think IUPUI still maintains its facilities. There are several very large high schools. And if you want to go north of Indianapolis about an hour, you have Purdue University, Big Ten school, obviously. You want to go south, you have Indiana University, obviously, Big Ten school. So there are lots of places to hold events. Here is my question. If in the first weekend of the tournament, they're usually in 8 different locations, and actually 9 if you include the first 4. Should we assume that when they tried to do this all in one place, that they're actually going to need 8 different sites? Or am I just thinking too literally?
You're thinking too literally. Look what the NBA did in Orlando. It took public assembly space, like convention center space, and made it into multiple courts and made it into multiple practice facilities as well. Don't forget, you need practice and training facilities through this tournament as well. So with just the ones you mentioned that are in or immediately around Indianapolis, that could very well be sufficient in and of itself.
I think it's worth noting that the exhibit halls can also be broken down into multiple courts as well, as they did for some youth leagues over the summer. They broke, I believe it was 5 or 6 different exhibit halls into 2 courts each and still maintained social distancing as needed by the Marion County Public Health Department. So not just ballrooms, but really the entire convention center can be utilized if absolutely necessary.
One of the selling points, I think, for Indianapolis was that a couple of months ago, the Indiana Sports Corp, which is a local not-for-profit that was established many years ago, specifically to lead this process of bringing sports events to Central Indiana, they put together a detailed proposal for all college basketball teams and leagues and laid out extensive plans for how it could create basketball bubbles, basically virus-resistant bubbles, similar to what the NBA did in Orlando. And the idea was to create a series of courts in the Indiana Convention Center where you could host a tournament or even league play. And Mickey, can you bring us up to date on whether or not anybody has taken them up on that particular bit of it?
So every year, the Bankers Life Fieldhouse hosts the State Farm Champions Classic. And this year, it is hosting that again. But the Indiana Sports Corp and really the city as a whole, they're considering that to be a bubble because it is a controlled environment and there are going to be heavy testing protocols in place. And I should mention no fans as well. And in addition to that, the Fieldhouse is also going to be hosting the Jimmy V Classic. There's going to be 2 games on December 2nd, the day after the Champions Classic takes place, also without fans. Yeah, they're bubbles, but I think that the other shoe still has to drop on the full-on bubbles yet. My understanding is there's still maybe 1 or 2 that are floating out there as bubble opportunities for the city. That just haven't been finalized yet. There's no word as of today on when those details might be put out there, but I would suspect that we could be hearing about it relatively soon.
Oh yeah, going back to the broadcast partners, and I know I'm going to sound like I graduated from Butler University here. I did not go to Butler University. But if I'm CBS Sports and Turner Sports, don't I want the atmosphere of these games, I mean, especially if there are no fans there, just to feel as much like a college environment as possible? I mean, to have a place like Hinkle Fieldhouse that is like a cathedral for college basketball, where even the acoustics, I mean, sound like basketball. Wouldn't they be pressing, you know, instead of having the games broadcast from some kind of convention hall, from like a legit 100-year-old sports arena that already has all the sidelines figured out and things like that?
Sure. It would make it easier. Games have been broadcast from there already. The lighting is already in place for it. Cabling should be in place, or at least they know where to put the cables and where to put the trucks. And the environment might be better. But then again, if there are no fans in the stands, that might offset some of the environment issues. What really gives Butler and Fieldhouse some benefit is the fact that they have all the player facilities, the medical facilities, the training facilities, the locker rooms already in place. Those can be temporarily replicated to a degree in convention centers, but they're already there. There's so many of these medical facilities in and of themselves, not counting all the locker facilities that are needed, but you can do it. The NBA certainly did it. It costs a lot of money. But there are reasons that one would think 5 miles away, yeah, that's one of our spots. I can definitely see that happening. And then if you have the field house where the Pacers play, and you have at least those two, you know, even if they don't use the Lucas Oil Stadium, they have the makings of facilities where they could put most of the especially bigger events.
And a lot of the fan environment can be inserted virtually. I think we're seeing at the beginning where they're just kind of piping in crowd noise. Thing, you know, didn't work really well, but they're getting much better at it. I mean, it's amazing to see how they progress. I mean, I can point to, WWE, their Thunderdome, and they're moving now to a new facility to really just construct a studio for a virtual fan experience. So I think, you know, if we're dealing still with a virtual environment, you know, by that time, that I would expect that the production quality would be pretty close. That if you didn't know there weren't fans there, you wouldn't know there weren't fans there.
You know, Larry's point is absolutely right. They've learned, the broadcasters and the leagues, the teams, they've learned a lot from the NBA, how to make the facilities feel to the people at home like it's as close as you can get to the crowds being there. But even more importantly, I think, they have figured out ways to make the players and coaches not feel like they're just in a practice facility. With the music, with the organist, with the, you know, the pump up the crowd kind of stuff, with the PA announcers. I mean, think about it, guys. In Orlando, they were doing full PA announcements of fouls and timeouts and all of that stuff. And there was nobody in the building except the players and the coaches. So they really wanted to make players feel like it was as close to a live game as they could as well.
And for the brief moment that it was just pure, it has been a great for sports purists, that you could hear the squeak of the sneakers on the floor. You know, you can hear, I mean, one of the things that I've really enjoyed personally is the fields are mic'd up. And so you can hear players, individual, their players, what they're saying. You know, you can hear the conversations on the field of play, on the court. Those have been great insights for the purists. But I don't anticipate by the spring that we'd still be in that position.
So let's say sometime in mid-December, they say, okay, we got the deal done. Central Indiana is going to host March Madness. You know, speaking of madness, I mean, that sounds to be like just a very short period of time to put together, I mean, something incredibly big. Is that doable?
I think the silence tells you that none of us really know yet.
It's doable, but I don't want to do it.
There you go. We've got about, I think, 6 minutes left. Am I missing any big points here? Any important elements of this that we haven't talked about yet?
I do want to actually respond a little bit to your last question, Mason, and just note that we really don't know whether it's doable because it's never been done before. But I think that there are a lot more moving parts that a lot of people aren't even considering. That being that Indianapolis is already scheduled to host a litany of events in the first quarter of next year, some at the convention center, some at Bankers Life potentially, and that's a very tricky situation for Visit Indy and the Sports Corp and other city officials to navigate. So I think if they can navigate through that, then it'll obviously help their chances of being able to pull it off. And obviously it's part of the effort that's going on right now. But keeping in mind that this isn't just the only event that's going to happen in Indianapolis or scheduled to happen in Indianapolis, is, I think, something that will help bring us some perspective.
You know, Mason, let's not ignore something that's going on in the country right now. Pfizer, just a couple of days ago, announced that they're ready to distribute, they asked the FDA for approval to distribute their vaccines, and they said they will start distributing them within hours of FDA approval. Moderna is there. J&J is right behind them. AstraZeneca with Oxford is very close also. And we have 100 million doses of each of these vaccines already produced while they've been in testing. I say this because if they start distributing in December, we may be in a very different situation come March and April than we are today, the week before Thanksgiving in 2020. And you know, that's something we should not ignore. It may be a far more manageable pandemic in 4 months than it is today.
Well, I hope so. That would be great.
With that, though, do you think it's like we're at a point now, Mark, where the NCAA could go back on what they just said? Or do you think right now it like the only way that the NCAA's term is going to happen is if they move forward with the one site solution?
I think the only way they can go forward is the one site solution. And let me give you a reason why I say that. You can't count on the vaccine distribution, the vaccine efficacy. It is more than a hope, but it is less than something you can rely on. With that in mind, everyone just has to approach at least the first quarter of the year the way they are the last quarter of this year.
You prepare for the pivot to video, and that's for fans, for sponsors. I think you're going to have all those in place because that can run anyway. And if we have live fans, that's an added bonus. But otherwise, be prepared to pivot to video.
Thank you so much for making time late in the day. This is a big help.
Great. Thanks, guys.
My thanks again to Mark Gannis, Larry DeGaris, and Mickey Shuey. Before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to draw your attention to several strong stories in the latest print edition of IBJ. The latest surge in COVID-19 cases has local restaurateurs fretting that public officials are on the cusp of imposing severe restrictions that they say will force hundreds of local eateries to close, some permanently. Mickey Shuey explores the challenges they face as they head into the winter months. And Susan Orr presents several local case studies for how restaurants have been able to survive so far. Also in this week's issue, Sam Quinn tracks the latest developments at Marion University as it continues to set and meet aggressive goals for expanding its programs and enrollment. And Kirk Christian catches up with auto racing legend Bobby Rahal, whose team took the top two spots of this year's Indy 500 and is now building a $20 million headquarters in Zionsville. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online, of course, at IBJ.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all the latest news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll be back again next week.